This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition. Join us at traditiononline.org, where you can subscribe to our quarterly print journal, sign up for email newsletters, or follow us on Facebook to keep updated on everything in our journal of Orthodox Jewish thought, including our soon-to-be-released special book-length volume on the intellectual legacy of Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, co-published with the Rabbi Sachs Legacy. Recently, I became a first-time grandfather to not one, but two beautiful baby girls born about a month apart to my eldest daughter and my eldest son. I recall the wise words of an older sister-in-law who cautioned my wife and myself when we first became parents. The days are long, but the years fly by. How true it was. The arrival of these two little ones has made me quite nostalgic for when my kids were little and we spent hours and hours reading together, among my favorite experiences as a parent. All the books I had loved as a child, Pooh and poems by Shel Silverstein, the Narnia series, The Hobbit, and of course, Lord of the Rings, as well as new books that the kids and I discovered and became enchanted by together. I suppose Harry Potter is the first among them. These memories took on even sharper focus in reading Alana Kershan's new memoir, Children of the Book, a memoir of reading together, from St. Martin's Press. Kershan, whose first book, If All the Seas Were Ink, won the Sammy Rohr Prize in Jewish Literature, is quite simply one of the best contemporary writers on the Jewish scene. And her Children of the Book resonates with all of my own experiences that I just mentioned, but from a decidedly maternal rather than paternal perspective. I guess for many mothers, especially literary-minded ones, the years of raising young children may feel like an intellectual regression. In this episode of our podcast, Kershan talks with Sarah Ridner Bloom, a teacher and writer living in Israel, who reviewed the book in our recent summer 2025 issue. You can read it open access at traditiononline.org. Together, the reviewer and her subject discuss how the time spent reading books with our kids can yield profound intellectual and spiritual insights, not to mention deeper and more enjoyable relationships. In Children of the Book, Ilana explores the ways in which reading books, and certainly, of course, learning Torah in the context of family life, is uplifting and transformative. In this conversation, Ilana and Sarah compare reading the same children's books over and over and over again to aspects of prayer. They consider the rejection of the avodah zarah of the digital screen in favor of books as a metaphor for the biblical transition from idolatry to monotheism. They also delve into that question so many parents wrestle with: how do we get our kids to be readers? And special concern of creating Anglo-Israeli children into readers of English books we all loved as kids. Good luck to us all with that. Here's their conversation.
Thank you so much for sitting with me today to talk about Children of the Book and perhaps some other interesting matters that may arise. Reading this book, I just couldn't believe on a personal level how many aspects of it tracked on to my own experience, you know, raising a bunch of kids, thank God, here in Israel, trying to transmit a love of literature, particularly English literature, in a culture where English is not the dominant language. And also doing that against the backdrop of the Jewish calendar, the Torah reading cycle, the Chagim, and also just all of these crazy world crises we've been living through. I couldn't believe how many personal parallels were there for me. But also on a more philosophical level, and I guess that's maybe where our conversation should focus, I feel like the book opens up truly new insights into the way we understand literature and Torah learning as it in the context of family life. Meaning it's not that we just love books and we read them to our kids and, you know, and then they pick up great skills. It's our understanding of those books changes when we read them with our kids, and also our family life also is kind of transformed or enriched or also changed in some very important and profound way when it takes place with this narrative backdrop of the books we read to them, you know. And that's something that's very meaningful and even practical, like in terms of parenting, but also intellectually, philosophically, like something going on here when you read, you know, reading in the context of family. And I felt like your book really opens up that conversation and opens up, you know, so many insights into so many, like, you know, aspects of family life and also, you know, just what literature means, Torah reading. I mean, there's just so much here to unpack. And so I really enjoyed the book and thank you for writing it.
For your review, I will say that when I read the review, I've never met you, Sarah, but when I read the review, I kept thinking, she is such a kindred spirit, this reviewer. We have to hang out. We have to talk. And I'm so grateful that now we have this opportunity because it was so clear from your review that, you know, they always talk about the ideal reader, who would be the best person who could appreciate your book. I felt like you were really an ideal reader. So
thank you so much. Thank you. I know I was describing my book, your book, to my mom at some point. She said, wait, did you write this book? Like, who wrote this book?
Exactly.
And I just love to hear your thoughts. Like, tell me, like, what prompted you to write it? What was the experience like?
Yeah, sure. So the book, it's as you said, it's a memoir, a memoir about reading with my children. And I tell the book through the lens of the five books of Moses. So in each part of the book, I explore the connections between the books I've read with my kids over time and the Torah, the book that we Jews never stop reading. And that's because, of course, you know, we are constantly in the middle, in the liturgical cycle, we're constantly in the middle of reading from the Torah, starting in the fall with Sefer Bereishit and concluding, right, at the following fall, right, as summer ends, concluding with Sefer Dvarim. And so I write in my book about how all the books I've read with my children, everything from Goodnight Moon and The Very Hungry Caterpillar to Charlotte's Web, Little Women, all those books unfold in the context of the ancient story of the Torah. So the arc of the book is really, it's from paradise to the promised land. Paradise being the very first books we read with our kids when they're born. And the promised land being that moment when our kids go off on their own, leaving us like Moshe atop the mountain, watching as they enter new lands and read new books without us. So I suppose you could say I'm writing about parenthood as a sacred journey that maps out onto the Bible's narrative and about how we learn to read our kids by reading with them, both sacred and secular literature. And yeah, the way it emerged was really just that I've always been in the midst of reading books and writing about books. I keep journals religiously. Maybe I shouldn't use that word, but I'm always writing. And I write about what I'm thinking, and because my head is always in a book, a lot of what I'm thinking about is what I'm reading, and what I'm reading with my children. And so that dialogue between lived experience and text has always felt very natural for me. And when I became a parent, you know, my children and the world of children's literature folded into that conversation. And that's what I tried to explore in this book.
Right. That's also additionally something I feel like that doesn't get spoken about in the same way. You know, parenting and raising children, it's meaningful. It's, you know, it changes your life. It exhausts you. But it's also on some level for many of us, a literary experience, right? Yeah. You're constantly reading when you have kids and you're rereading in a way that you certainly don't when you're, you know, an adult devouring novels. And there's a way in which the rereading of these favorite books, sometimes ad nauseum, can actually like reveal incredible insights, you know?
Yes.
And obviously that's also going on as Jews when we reread our sacred texts.
Yes. Yeah, I have to say that I've never been, I had never been, I should say, a rereader. I've always been very into like how covering new ground, reading books I've never read before. I keep lists of books I've read and I get excited as I, read more and more in a particular series or more books by an author. And it was really only when I became a parent that I came to appreciate the value of rereading because, of course, children like to hear the same books again and again and again, right? No sooner do you turn the last page than they're already throwing the book at you, shoving it in your face, begging you to, start all over again, again, again. And it made me appreciate that really that's a very Jewish way of reading because, as I said, we Jews are constantly rereading our sacred texts, and living out our life against the backdrop of those sacred texts. And it also made me think about, it's not just Torah that we're constantly rereading, but as Jews, we also are constantly, when we daven, when we pray, right? We are reading the same book again and again every day, right? And we're reading the same parts of that book every day at the same times of day. That is to say, our liturgy is very repetitive, which is very different from the way that other faith traditions pray, right? Like we don't just spontaneously utter, what we're feeling when the spirit moves us. We have a fixed text that we can use as a template in which to interject our own prayers of the moment, but we're really given a text that we repeat and re return to. And the point of reading the Siddur over and over, i.e., the point of davening, is not to say, "Oh, been there, done that, read this book, I can add it to my list. Let me go look at this author wrote another one or whatever." That's not what
Right.
we're doing when we're davening. We're trying instead to forge connection with God. And that really made me think about how the experience of reading with children. The point is not to get through the book. The point isn't even to get through the book seven times or 47 times. The point is, what kind of connection are you forging with your child by reading that book again and again? And when you read that book again and again, it's almost like a controlled experiment where like you're limiting the number of variables because it's the same book, which means you can be attuned to what is it like to read the book with this child as opposed to with your other older children that you read it with before. What
So
does this
true.
child notice, right? That those children do? What questions does this child ask? What comes up? What does this child share for you?
Right. So I know exactly what you mean. Like you get into this mode. There's certain books that are already worn through in our house, like Madeline or Little Blue
Yes.
Truck or Goodnight Moon, obviously,
Yes.
the Big Red Barn. And you just kind of like at a certain point, you know them by heart. And
Yes.
you read them just again and again with your kids. You're not even thinking as you're reading. It's kind of becomes
Yes.
like almost like a mantra or some sort of like chant. And what's happening at the same time that you're just kind of mindlessly reading these words is that your child sitting next to you and their head is drooping into your shoulder and you know what I mean? And what's happening is a relationship is being
Yes.
strengthened. And to think of that as a model of what we want for our prayer also, when we're holding that, prayer book and rereading the same words we've read
Yes,
for so many times is such a, I
yes.
think it's such a evocative, powerful like idea.
Yes, and just like our children never get tired of hearing the same books again and again, God never gets tired of hearing our tefillot again and again, right? Like the Gemara says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitaveh letefilatan shel tzadikim, that God, right, lusts, literally, like lusts for the prayers of the righteous. Like God wants our tefillah, God needs our tefillah. In the same way that our children want and need to hear those books over and over. And when I had that realization, it really made me think differently about what I'm trying to, what the tefillah experience is about. I was going to say what I'm trying to get out of the tefillah experience, but I think it's just the opposite. It's not what I'm trying to get out. It's really, what is this experience supposed to be like, not just for me, but also for God and for my connection with God. So it really lent me, I think, religious insight, that ex you know many religious insights, but that's just one of them, that experience of reading and rereading. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that. And it's fun. It's, and you do sometimes I feel like I switch up my books, not even always for my in terms of my kids' interests, but you're kind of sometimes in the mood to read
Yes,
something
absolutely.
new yourself. I
Yes.
mean, like it adds a dimension of joy to
Yes.
parenting.
If you enjoy reading aloud to your kids are going to enjoy it, right? Like if you're having
Oh.
fun and it's your pleasure is visible, like it's that much. It doesn't mean that you always have to be having fun, because that would be
For
impossible.
sure. No,
But when you
definitely
are
not.
able to have fun, it's great.
Yeah, I think there's kind of like a certain kind of anxiety, obviously, especially us moderns,
Yes.
associate with parenting, and there's so many like points of conflict and things we want them to do that they're not doing, and pressures we feel and pressures they feel. And like when you enter the just this kind of reading land,
Yeah.
it reorients you entirely, and them and
Yeah. Yeah. There's a sense in which time slows down when you read with a child. Like you just inhabit a different realm, as you say. Like, and it's you're in the world of the story, and suddenly, because there's so much, as you've said, in our modern lives, right? There's so much that's just of parenting that's just about rushing to get from point A to point B, or check things off the list, make sure the lunch is packed, make sure the backpack is zipped, make sure the kid is out the door in time, and if not, they have the permission slip that's gonna, the late notice. And but there's just so many things to constantly be checking off, and you're fighting the clock. And I don't know, there's something about just being able to experience time in a different way. It's like the way we experience time on Shabbat. It's like this man olam haba, you're just in a different temporal experience where suddenly you're like suspended in time rather than like steamrolling through time. And it's very important, I think, for children to be able to relate to their parents when their parents are in Shabbat mode and not in Chol mode. And then I think that reading mode, which we can do all week long, it's like kind of that main Olam Habav Shabbat, bring it into the week a little bit, which is very special.
But you did mention Shabbat a lot in the book, because it functions on different levels. Like on one hand, it's the time when we read the most.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a built-in. I mean, I know that not everyone has the same sort of obsession with reading that you do. If you permit me
Right.
to call it that, and commitment to it. But at the same time, the fact that, as observant Jews, we don't have, meaning Shabbat is just a kind of, it opens up space for reading and the life of a family, in a very real way, I think, for most observant families. But also, what you're saying is very interesting, that the actual act of reading, is there something Sabbath-like in just the act of stopping to do that. And one of my favorite passages in your book was when you discuss the hungry caterpillar, and made this great point, which actually is absolutely true, that there's a way in which the days of the book are parallel to the days of creation. And I think that's, and when does it, does it end with Saturday? It ends, or it ends with,
Well, it in the end, the last day is not Saturday, but
last day is the cocoon.
the last day is the cocoon experience, which is a Shabbat-like experience of resting and resting and thinking that nothing is happening. Just like on Shabbat, we always have this. I always have the sense of like, I'm not accomplishing anything. I'm certainly not writing any more words or teaching any more classes or writing any drashot or whatever, translating any more books or all the various other things we might do during, I'm not getting anything done on my to-do list. And yet something is happening on Shabbat. There's a lot that is developing. Like there's it's sort of like difference between being mode and doing mode, where we can be very dismissive of just that being mode, which Shabbat is really about. But there's something that is nonetheless still happening. And when you see that, he was a beautiful butterfly on the last page, you realize that in that dormant cocoon state, there was so much that was gestating. I don't know if that's the right word for a caterpillar, but pupating, I don't know what the word is, but there was so much that was happening. And that is what Shabbat is like also. And I think so much of child rearing is like that too, that on the day to day, you feel like your kid is going to have the same tantrum every single day, or every single day they're going to get upset about what's for dinner, and they're always going to insist on leaving the house before their sibling or whatever the things kids get hung up on. And you feel like this is never going to end, and my kid is going to walk down the wedding aisle insisting that he gets to suck his lollipop or whatever. You feel like it's never going to end, and yet we don't notice, because we're spending so much intense time with our children. We don't notice those subtle changes as they happen, we only, you know, it's the grandparents who come once every few months and noticed or whatever, you know, like they're like, your kids have grown so much. And we're like, really? We haven't seen it. But that is so much of what parenting is about. You don't see from close up the changes, but you know, that in that cocoon state, there is so much metamorphosis that's happening. And there's so much metamorphosis. Children grow so fast, even though it seems to us as parents that, you know, they're never going to grow up and we're going to be parenting little children forever and nothing's ever going to get easier or whatever. It happens whether we want it to or not, you know? And in that sense, the Very Hungry Caterpillar, yeah, it really became a metaphor for me for both the experience of weekday and Shabbat, and also I think on another level, which I sort of tried to hint at in the subjects of the book, of also, yeah, what it's like to parent and to have that sort of close range and also long range perspective, and to need to have both perspectives
You have a
simultaneously.
great chapter also on the concept of Bittul Torah and
Yes.
how painful it can be, particularly as a mother, like who, you know, who has dreams, who has ambitions, who has plans, who I'm sure has a long list of fascinating things to write about. And sort of what does it mean to put that aside, like, you know, all the time for many hours a day and do things like, you know,
Fold laundry, pack lunches. Yeah.
Exactly, and you know, shuttle them to chugim, to after school activities and whatnot. And if you dwell on that, it's enough to make you, I mean, it can just be really, you know, exasperating and frustrating. But when you, what I think the gift of your book and this perspective is that it transforms that time, right? That dead time when you're just, you know, putting kids to bed or, you know, attending to their wounds or whatever it is. And it transforms that into, you know, part of a story, part of like a really, you know, rich and powerful and important kind of story of raising a child, building a family, you know, the stress of growing up. And
I often think about chapters in my children's lives. I mean, even just that metaphor of chapters, I didn't realize it till I said it, but in terms of the books we were reading during that period, like, oh, you know, this is when my son was in the goodnight construction site phase, you know, oh yeah, I remember that. We had to read that book every single night. You know, I remember like periods in their childhood by what we were reading at the time. And conversely, I also associate certain children's books with, you know, a certain period in my life, you know, when I was reading that book over and over. So it is really interesting. And in that sense, it's kind of like the same way that I think of, you know, I don't know, I always think about we generally come to Parshat Noach just around the first time it rains, you know, the rainy season begins in Israel. Like you have these, which, you know, makes, you know, it's like it makes nice poetic sense. But we have this, you know, we have these associations with Parshiot and the seasons and time of year. Times of year, and it's nice to have that kind of associations also with the books we read with our children. And as you say, like life becomes a series of overlapping narratives and stories, you know, when you experience life always against the backdrop of literature and of text.
absolutely. Do you want to take a few minutes to talk about the elephant in the room? For some, what do you think of sort of some of the pressures in modern life against reading, meaning screens and what's good, you know, what
Ah,
our older kids certainly would prefer to be
yeah.
doing. It's not Shabbat. How is that
No, no,
something
no, no, no,
that
no, no, no,
influences?
no. That's a very, that's, I was trying to figure out what you meant by the elephant in the room
Maybe it's
because,
not an elephant in every room. Maybe it's
no,
just.
no, no, no. It's funny that you said it because just we actually, my son has a little stuffed elephant, and literally just this morning, like it was on the breakfast table, and my husband was like, I know, I said, why is the elephant on the breakfast table? And my husband, in a joke, said, "Can we not talk about that? It's always best not to talk about the elephant in the room." And I started cracking up. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But now I understand what you mean, in a less literal sense. So we have, of course, the same problem with screens that everyone has, namely that they are present everywhere in our lives and unavoidable. And you know, as parents, we are dependent on them. And I think a lot about how, you know, screens really. They provide us with this instantaneous gratification. I think about, I mean, I'm talking about how are screens different from books? Because, you know, my kids will say to me sometimes, like, Yeah, we love stories too, but we can also get stories, you know, we can get stories from movies and, you know, and from YouTube videos, tell us stories or whatever, you know. And I think about the difference between reading a book and watching a movie. And I think there's something about, I think reading a book requires a certain amount of imagination, because you have to, of course, you have to imagine the characters. You have to imagine in your mind what they're going to look like. Like, I remember when I worked in book publishing, when I worked at Random House, they used to always tell us, like, we never put images of characters' faces on the covers of books, because then you constrain the reader who suddenly has to picture that character in a certain way, as opposed to giving the imagination of the reader full rein to depict that to picture that
Think
character as
about
they
right
will, right?
the traditional prohibition against graven images that's often interpreted by Jewish artists to refer to to faces. It's very
Absolutely,
very interesting.
absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's also the reason, by the way, why so many children's books feature animals, and you know, picture books feature animals instead of human characters, because you want children to be able to relate to the characters in the book. And it might be hard for a black child to relate to white character, or a Chinese child to relate to a white character in the book. But if the characters are all mice, then any child can imagine
There you go.
themselves
I never actually thought
with the
about that
mouse.
before, and it is true. So many children's books
It makes children's book characters so much
animals.
more universally relatable, because no human child looked like a mouse. And in that sense, every human child has equal opportunity to look like a mouse, right? And when we read books with our children, at whenever any of us read books, we really have to do that work of imagining. And I think this is especially profound when children make that shift from picture books to chapter books, like around the age of 7 or 8, when kids start reading to themselves longer books that don't have pictures on every page, or only have pictures every few pages, if at all. And those pictures may only be in black and white. I'm thinking of like the Little House on the Prairie books, or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is like this, Charlotte's Web is like this. You know, Ivy and Bean is like this. There are pictures every few pages, but you don't get a visual aid on every page, which means that you really have to do that imaginative work on your own, right? And I think of that kind of imaginative work as being like as opposed to, right? And I'll just say this quickly, as opposed to when you're watching a video, when you're watching on a screen, when the images flash fully formed before you. And the analogy that comes to mind, and I explore this in my book, is what happens on Mount Sinai when Moshe shows up on the mountain to receive the Torah from an invisible, abstract, intangible God. And the people down below are like Jonathan Haidt's Anxious Generation. Like, we can't handle this. Like, we need screens. We need to be able to see, right? We need to be able to see the images fully before us. Without Moshe, how are we supposed to believe in God? How are we supposed to believe there really is the God out there? And so what do? They fashion a golden calf, and the words that Aaron uses to describe, you know, how that calf is formed, right? He just puts everything into the fire, and as if like by miracle, right? The calf like just emerges, right? As if Aaron didn't even have to do anything. You know, it almost happens spontaneously, instantaneously. The egel hazehav is like the instantaneous gratification of a screen, whereas what God wants of us is to be able to be patient and to imagine and to establish a relationship that requires tremendous moral imagination, tremendous empathic capabilities. If we think about the primary mandate in the Torah to love the stranger, right? That requires tremendous moral imagination, and a moral imagination very similar to what is demanded of us when we read a story. What is it like to imagine what it is to be another character? What does it feel like to know that you are being fattened for slaughter on Christmas, and your only friend, your only ally is an articulate, friendly spider in the roof of the barn, right? Or whatever. Like, you have to imagine, you have to do that work yourself. And I think that imaginative work, you know, it's what makes reading such a slow pleasure, right? It doesn't come to us, it doesn't come quickly. And I experienced this especially when I was teaching my kids how to read, and they were stumbling over every word, and you know, confusing homonyms and parsing sentences incorrectly. You come to appreciate that, you know, the rabbis say that a person doesn't learn Torah unless they stumble over it, right? Like, you really need to, like, in the same way, like, the greatest learning happens when we stumble our way through, when it takes time and demands a lot of us and doesn't happen instantaneously. So to answer your question, like, I don't feel like I can avoid the screens in our lives, but I do think there's something powerful about, as you said, about the ban on visual art, in the historic ban on visual art that dates back to the Second Commandment, really. The idea of not making a graven image, leading to a tradition of art that was primarily geometric, abstract, what have you. And I think about how, what are our illuminations? What are the How do we illuminate our texts, right? If you think about like a medieval illuminated manuscripts, right? Like they have these, geometric designs in the margins, and what illuminates our texts also? What illuminates our texts, or what takes the place of those illustrations, or what is also in those margins? Commentary, right? Like Rashi's commentary is sort of like the illumination. It illuminates the text for us. And I try to think about when I'm reading with my kids, like what role are those pictures playing, those interspersed pictures that we don't see on every page? Once they are reading chapter books, how do those illustrations function as a kind of Rashi's commentary that shed light on the text, help us, give us a little bit of aid in visualizing what's going on without giving us the full picture, but sort of help us along? They're kind of like training wheels to train us to be able to read without that kind of commentary, to read, because eventually, we all move into reading books that are, God willing, we all move into reading books that don't have any illustrations, or also reading books that don't have any illustrations. And I say also because I truly believe that no one ever graduates from picture books, that picture books are so rich, and the best picture books can speak to adults, children of all ages. We have a Every week we go to the library, and I take out, my older kids take out their own books, but I always take out a whole bunch of picture books for the week, and I just leave them on a couch in the hope that all my kids will, at some point when they're too tired to read anything else or do anything else, they'll just open them and leaf through them and read them. And I'm always leaving picture books lying around because I think they're highly underestimated in terms of their impact, and how they can move us and speak to us, and that rich interplay of text and illustration as an art form in and of its own. But even
That's
picture books, yeah, require
yeah,
that attention work.
no, absolutely. No, I think that's exactly right. I think the difference between picture books and screens, you could see screens as a way of like sort of representing something, but there is also even in the word, there's a separation, meaning it also blocks you, right? A screen
Yeah, it's
separates
beautiful.
you
That's beautiful.
and
That's
it
beautiful.
shields you from something as well. Whereas
Yeah.
a really a truly magnificent children's book where
Yes.
the illustrations are themselves a kind of commentary and
Yeah.
often they even invite you to kind of enter that conversation thinking about what you're looking at. There's a lot of really great children's books like The Monster at the End of This Book or
Yes.
Press Here, which kind
Yes, I love
of
that book. Yeah. Yeah.
reflect upon what the illustrations are doing, how they're interacting with the text.
Yes.
Illuminated manuscripts obviously do that as well, meaning there's a way in which you understand literally they're sort of surrounding the text. They're kind of
Yeah.
and once you know what they're doing, I think they really add to your appreciation of a book. In a way, it's a kind of it does. You lose. I mean, the transition from reading children's books to reading like older kid books and then
Yeah,
adult
yeah,
books is something
yeah.
you write about in the book. I think there's something really, it's kind of wistful or something. There's kind of
Yeah. And
something's
it, yeah, and
that
it
lost
requires,
that process. There's
yes.
also so many books that even reflect upon that, like the loss of something when you grow up a little. Like I mean, the Velvet
Yeah.
Rabbit is an
Yes,
example.
yes, 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 yes,
Toy Story
yes.
movies playing on that kinds of that theme
Yes.
of, what happens to our brains and our imagination as we grow up,
Yep, yep,
kinds
yep.
of things,
Yeah, I think,
what's
yeah.
gained and also what's lost, like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a transition akin to, I imagine, what Abraham Avinu had to go through when he, smashed Terach's idols and said, "Wait a second, I th this these are not God, right? I thought the sun was God, but the sun sets. I thought the moon was God, but the moon sets." And my father's statues are certainly not God, because they can be smashed so easily. They can, they can't even smash each other, right? And it's that ability to realize that, what we can see and grasp hold of in the world is only a fraction of the reality that is out there. In the same way that, if you picture the entire, no, you can't picture it, never mind. That's the whole paradox. But imagine the electromagnetic spectrum, right? A tiny band on that spectrum, if you remember from, like, whatever, 10th grade, whenever, physics or whenever you learn this, right? A tiny band on that spectrum is the visible light, the wavelengths of visible light. But the vast majority of the electromagnetic spectrum is microwaves, gamma rays, radio waves, what have you, that we human beings cannot visually apprehend. They say that dogs can sense certain, but we can't directly apprehend visually all that radiation, and yet we know it's out there. And I feel like that's sort of like what living with a religious sensibility is like. It's like, I know that God is in the world, but I certainly can't see God. I try to feel God. Occasionally I can feel God's presence. But for the most part, you're really acting on faith and searching, trying to seek out those moments when God's presence will become manifest and become known. But mostly we're moving around without the visual aids, without the tangible evidence. We don't have the sea splitting on a regular basis in our lives, or 10 plagues coming down from heaven. I mean, sometimes it feels like we do, but we don't see the God's outstretched arm directly in our lives. And what does it mean to intuit God's presence? It requires a real imaginative leap that is akin, I think, to the imaginative leap that reading demands of us. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, over Shabbat, I finished, I've read Narnia now a few times. I'm on my third read with my
Wow.
9-year-old son. And we finished the series. I think I can say, I don't know if it's a spoiler for anyone listening, but the great surprise at the end. Narnia is kind of like an escape land, right? It's for the earth, the human beings are, I mean, the sort of residents of Earth who enter it,
Yes.
kind of
Yes.
has a different, operates under a different time frame. It obviously totally different rules. No one,
Right.
the good guys usually die, and nothing. It's
Right.
kind of
Right.
it's
Right.
a
Right.
stand-in for the world of imagination and the world of literature in many ways.
Yes.
And the great surprise at the end, or maybe it's not a surprise at all, is that world of imagination that they were entering was actually a lot closer to the real world than the world they were in. And I and
Realizing the truth in imagination, right? Like, yeah.
exactly, as a taste, it doesn't necessarily get, reading English literature, and this is where we obviously need our Torah dimension as well. I mean, it's not necessarily giving us a full picture of what the true, what truth is, but it's giving us a glimmer in the sense that we're not seeing the whole thing, the whole
Yeah,
picture.
yeah,
And
yeah, yeah.
what's amazing about reading as a parent is that you're kind of like, as an adult, you kind of move through the stages. You end up in, let's say the most abstract stage of all, as a reader. But then when you read with your kids, you actually return to all those previous stages, and you kind of inhabit them at once, right?
Yes, yes,
You're
yes.
especially, at this stage that we're, thank God, in, where we have, very little kids, slightly older kids, and we're finding ourselves, at all these different stages of abstraction and of kind of development of imagination
Yes.
and whatnot at once. And
Yes.
I find it all to be incredibly illuminating. I find it to be almost a spiritual experience, because
Yes.
obviously we want to move away from images in a way to get
Yes.
more abstract, but really the truth is in color, right?
Yes. Yes.
The truth has pictures,
Yes.
has
Yes. Yes.
all
Yes. Yes.
senses.
Yes.
So there's
It's wonderful. That's beautiful. Yeah.
So I feel lucky. I think it's a great stage to be in, even though it's also exhausting at times. And
Yes. Yes, one of the greatest things about being a parent is you really have this excuse to revisit all the books that you got to read when you got to be a kid again, and reread all, you have a built-in excuse to reread all those books that I certainly thought I couldn't imagine I would ever come back to. And then I remember sort of in like before I had children, I would remember to ask myself, like, which book should I save from my childhood? What books would I want to ever reread? And I don't know, think it even occurred to me to think, like, would I save books for any children I might have someday? And now I'm so grateful that, thank God, my parents had the prescience to save certain books that I have so much delighted in reading with my kids, the same copies that I read when I was a kid. Sometimes now that they're even getting older into, more sophisticated books, sometimes those books are even annotated with my notes, which at first really horrified my kids. Like, how dare I write in a book? They think of books as sacred. And I had to sort of, I write in a lot of the books I read because I review a lot of books, and I know you do too, Sarah. But that also took some, that was a bit of a shock for my kids to discover all my annotated books. But there's something very special about being able to revisit those books again later in life and perhaps see them with a different lens, experience them. Like, I remember always thinking A Wrinkle in Time was about kids searching for their father who was far away. And then I was reading that book to my daughter last year when my husband was on sabbatical in South Korea for the year. And suddenly it became a book about a mother who had to function without her husband around. And I was like, wow, never realized that dimension of the book before, as the mother is staring into her Bunsen burner and trying not to cry. I was like, wow. And the book gave me the chills in a whole different way. And I think that really the best literature, like Torah, Lehavdil, but yes, the best literature can be read again and again and again. And every time you read it, you discover, you come up with new insights. And become attuned to something you hadn't seen before because you're a different person and you're not in the same place in your life.
Absolutely. Trying to think if we should move on to the book recommendation portion of
Well, yeah.
the podcast. Well, we were kind of so one place. I mean, there's a way in which I learning Torah and reading books. There's a lot of overlap. They also diverge ways in many important ways, meaning studying. I mean, I don't know if you've had this experience. Like, I find the act of learning with my kids can be very meaningful, but it's tiring, and it's right. You can't just kind of
Yes,
and
absolutely.
chant from memory in the same way. I mean,
Yes, it often feels like dentistry and the pulling teeth sense. So yes. I always say I spend as much time convincing my son to sit down and learn Mishnah with me as we actually spend learning Mishnayot every single time. So, you just have to double the amount of time it takes. But once I get his attention, we could learn for an hour, but it can take up to an hour to get that attention. So,
I mean, it's, it is what it is, and I'm sure learning with you is an absolute pleasure, and your kids are very happy.
I don't know if you would say that, but thank you.
One amazing addition to the Jewish bookshelf recently that's been published is an English translation of the HaParsha
Yes.
book series written by Israeli journalist Emily Amrusi,
Yes.
which was a huge, huge hit in Israel. It's a kind of, I would say, shot-based retelling of the Torah in a way that is immensely readable, incorporates traditional interpretations and midrash, and it does so in a way that flows like a story.
Yeah.
And it's been made even more accessible recently through your incredible translation for Magid Press.
Thank
Actually,
you.
I grabbed a copy just
Yes,
to
they're
show
beautiful
our
books. Good you grabbed
readers.
a copy because they're, speaking of like the visual, they're so visually arresting. The illustrations are just magnificent. Yeah. I know you wrote about the illustrations, Sarah.
Menachem Halberstadt is the illustrator. He writes a weekly he creates sorry he paints or creates a weekly Parsha illustration every week for the Makori Show newspaper here in Israel. And he his illust like to me, that's how you do it right. Like, if you're gonna translate, if you're gonna try to depict the Torah in images, what he's doing is so clearly kind of he even also like stays away from faces you see at certain times. Like, I think the Matan Torah picture and the Sinai picture, you see how the faces are just they're kinds of they're just a little bit blurred over. Like there's a kind of the way in which you're encouraged in that picture to think about how they're receiving the Torah. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I think he does. It's really, you can almost analyze the pictures on their own, like as
yes.
commentary. It's such a great series.
One of my favorite illustration. I don't know if maybe, but in the Lech Lecha chapter, when God tells Abraham to look up at the sky and to count the stars, and if you can count the stars, ko yeh zarecha. The way Menachem Halberstadt illustrates that scene, he has Abraham looking up at the sky, and all the stars are arranged in the shapes of fetuses in the womb. Yo, you have it. Oh, beautiful. Yeah, exactly. That's my favorite of the illustrations. And it's like, it really makes me think that, you know, what was it like for Abraham to have faith in God? Apropos of the earlier part of our conversation, what was it like for Abraham to be able to see God? Some people would just look up at the sky and see a random assortment of stars in the sky. But what made Abraham, Abraham? Why did Abraham, you know, why was he fit to be the first monotheist? Because Abraham could look up at the sky and see that those stars were in the shapes of babies. Abraham could, in the absence of any biological evidence that he would be able to have children, and indeed with evidence only to the contrary, based only on a promise from a God he couldn't see or touch, right? Based on that alone, Abraham was able to have the faith that he would have children, and he was able to look up at the stars. And of course, he had to fight his way through a lot of doubt. And we're, you know, Torah is a very human text, and we see that doubt, we hear about that doubt. But Abraham, nonetheless, is able to look up at the sky and see that multiplicity of descendants that he's going to have. The stars form those constellations. And it's true that when two people, like the stars in the sky are like a Rorschach test, you know, we see different things, and, you know, not everyone would connect the dots in the same way, but Abraham is able to connect the dots in a way that signifies the divine promise. And that's what made him Abraham. And I think that the illustration captures that so beautifully. And there's so much to talk about in reading those books with children. There's just, I love the way, you know, she really does adhere pretty closely to the pshat, when she does need, as you said, when she does need to go into, occasionally she will use some midrash, but she does it brilliantly in a way that often she's able to make it clear that she is veering off into the world of midrash. Like I know even in that Lech Lecha chapter, right, Lech Lecha starts out with Abraham, you know, traveling with his family to get to Canaan. But we know from the Midrash fills in a lot in the transition from Noach to Lech Lecha, where Abraham, as we talked about, smashes his father's idols, what have you. And the way Emily Amrusi deals with those Midrashim, which many children are familiar with and are really serve to make the text accessible to all of us, right? And to make Abraham understandable and relatable to all of us, because after all, why would God choose Abraham? All those Midrashim come to answer that question, to address that lacuna in the text, right? But what she does so powerfully, she tells it like a flashback. So she starts out, the first picture is Abraham and Sarai and Lot, and they're on a camel and they're traveling in the desert. And then you turn the page, and on the next page it says, Abraham didn't always do whatever God told him. And then you flash back, right? And there's all these scenes of Abraham's childhood and the sun and the moon and what have you. And it's so well done, because it's so easy for the parent to just say, oh, in this flashback, everything that's happening in the past, that's what's in the Midrash. It kind of brackets, the flashback serves to bracket the Midrash, which I think was so clever on her part. The way the dialogue between Pshat and Drash, when it's there, happens is, I think, just, it's just brilliant the way she does it. I really, really, really recommend the books. And there's nothing self-interested here. I don't get royalties. And I just love the books. And I hope that they will find their way. And now that they're available in both Hebrew and English, I hope they'll find their way into more and more Jewish homes.
I agree. Thank you for all your services.
Oh, please. Oh, please. Thank you.
Jewish parents who like to read and want to or enriching things with their children. I mean, something really hit me when you were describing the way Avram looked into the sky at promises, in response to the promises made by Hashem. There's a way in which I think it's easy to think of our Jewish life, our like our religious aspirations, as you know, as something that takes place, you know, kind of like a, it's not in a vacuum, I would say, but it's something that is a kind of that we're trying to accomplish a lot of things on our own. We want to learn this. We want to take on this. We want to do this, and that's very important. And we need to. I mean, that's like a big part of religious life and growth. But there, what we see in the Torah from the very beginning is the way in which so much of these imperatives and so much of these goals are also wrapped up with transmission. They're wrapped up with raising kids.
Yes.
And
yes.
And what we do with them. And
yes.
And it's so relevant at so many crucial points, like in the Jewish calendar. Obviously, we see it at the Pesach Seder.
Yes. Yes.
Every night when we say Shema with our kids.
Yes.
And I think that's just something like us, you know, and it's obviously it's a time of life, you know, not everyone is in this space, you know, externally, you know, as teens or young adults who have aspirations, who are striving towards things. Obviously, this is not as on our minds. And once our kids are grown, that's also not necessarily exactly where we are. But right now, it's an important stage.
The Seder is really a great example of that, of the importance of transmission. I think a lot about how the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim is told in the Torah, how you know, the plagues unfold in a fairly repetitive, they have a very fairly repetitive structure where, you know, God tells Moshe and Aaron, or Moshe or Aaron, to bring a certain plague, and they warn Pharaoh about it, and the plague comes, whatever. There's a certain somewhat repetitive structure. But then you come to the ninth plague of darkness, and the 10th plague of Makat B'chorot, and suddenly everything changes, right? What happens in the transition from Choshech to Makat B'chorot, right? The 10th plague, God announces that the firstborn are going to be killed. But then before that plague, you expect that plague to come. But before it happens, you sort of get this rant, like sudden insertion of Shmot Perek Yud Bet, which is all about how are you going to tell the story of what's about to happen to your children, right? And it interrupts at the moment of highest tension, highest dramatic suspense, right? Like, are we going to get out of Egypt? Is this plague going to really kill Paro? Is it going to kill Paro? Is it going to kill the other performers? What's going to happen, right? As we're in this moment of suspense, God starts to tell us, like, and someday when your children ask you questions and you're just like, gosh, like, speed up the narrative. And I think it's intentional.
So postmodern. It's the original metafiction.
Right. It's I think it's intentional because the Torah wants to foreground how important this experience is. It's so important that we're going to narrate it even before it happens. And the whole experience is really happening so that we will narrate it, like, and tell this story. It's almost like a parent says to a kid, like, I'm going to take you tomorrow to the most amazing amusement park, and there are going to be rides and slides and swings and what have you. And one day when you have children of your own, you're going to tell your children, my parents took me to the most amazing amusement park, and there were rides and there were slides, what have you, right? It's like, you know, crazy. Why would you tell that to your kid? Let your kid have the experience and then decide if they think the experience is worthy of relaying to the next generation. But no, in the Torah, that idea of v'igadata levincha is so foregrounded. It is so important. And as Jews, we live our narratives. We embody our narratives. Like, what does it mean to put on tefillin? To put on tefillin is to wear our story. It's to wear the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, like, on our flesh, right? To kiss a mezuzah, right? We walk through every day our narratives. We inhabit our narratives. We embody our narratives because narrative is so central to what it means to be Jewish. And I think if we needed any more motivation to, you know, to read to our children, like, it is so, so fundamental to our religious tradition.